It may have been a mistake to start these recordings.
I have a feeling that people in this class have the idea that they can catch the lectures on the internet. But the problem is that I haven't used the recorder for the past couple of weeks. So. Yeah.
Engage in conversation, listen to
a
lecture, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly.
You remember yourself speaking more than the teacher?
Absolutely. Okay. I am going to tear up the sheet of this.
You got a job interview today?
Okay, we will all keep our fingers crossed and maybe we'll get some students. We've only got, what is it? Is it 3 weeks left? Or is it two and a half weeks left. So we're going to have to get on to Foucault, and we lost another one. Look at this. They're dropping like flies. We're going to have to get on to Foucault and surveillance at the beginning of next week if we're going to be able to get a shot at them, at that material at all. But today let's try to finish up with Habermas in any event. And remember how Habermas and Hobsbawm are related, besides the fact that they have closely similarly sounding names, and I get them confused all the time. What Hobsbawm is arguing in Barbarism and Use New Sky is that there has been a descent into what he calls barbarism. And what he really means by that is a movement away from the humane and enlightened values that he sees as having been on the upswing during the 19th century. There's been a retreat from that, beginning with the First World War and continuing into the current period. And all you need to do is to tick off a number of significant historical events. And for example, the Holocaust in the 30s and 40s, and the 40s in particular in Europe, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the various civil wars that have occurred more recently in Africa, and essentially the drug conflict in Colombia is another civil war. And you can see that the level of inhumanity on a large scale has increased. And one of the problems with this, Hobsbawm tells us, is that we've gotten used to it. It no longer shocks us. Now, we come to accept this as the status quo and as something that is simply unalterable. And remember, Hobsbawm does not mean to suggest that it is unalterable. He thinks that there are, at least there's a possibility of getting out of the situation that we're in, but clearly there's no possibility of getting out of it if we don't recognize that we're in it. And so what Hobsbawm is trying to do is to increase people's awareness of what the true dimensions of our contemporary condition are. If you wanted to put all of this in a nutshell, you know, what is it that distinguishes this period from the 19th century? At least in on the global scene and on the global publicly, the scene that's publicly visible, it's that this has been a century, the past 100 years or so, have been a century of massive human rights violations. Now, this is what Habermas needs to take into consideration when he tries in his own article, Toward a Constitution for a Pluralist World Society, that he needs to take this into account in his own attempt to revive Kant's project. Because this is precisely what did not characterize the situation when Kant was writing. You know, with one major exception, and it is something that Kant recognized, although he didn't really have a very good solution to it, and the major exception is the slave trade and the annihilation of the indigenous populations of the Americas. Kant registered both of those events, and he condemned both of them in Perpetual Peace, But he never indicates how his conception of a federation of free nation states would address that problem. But of course, what happened in the 20th century is that not only did massive human rights abuses continue to occur in what we used to call the Third World, but they made it to the very heart of the First World as well. They made it to the heart of Europe, and that, of course, raised the concern of Western thinkers, Western political thinkers. But in short, what Habermas is asking is, how is it possible to renew Kant's project for perpetual peace in light of the occurrence of massive human rights violations? And his answer is that it's necessary to reformulate the principles of perpetual peace, to stay in harmony with its ultimate purpose, which is to create a global system that's able to resolve disputes short of war, but also to incorporate in it the eventuality of human rights abuses of a large scale coming from nation states themselves, in other words, being visited upon their own domestic populations by nation states. How does a structure, an international structure, intervene in those kinds of situations? And Habermas is obviously not philosophizing in a vacuum. He's constantly making reference to real developments that concern the emergence and the evolution of the United Nations, you know, particularly in the current period. And I think he's interested in two things. One is the fact that the UN has come to, with pretty much the agreement of all the member nations, has come to be concerned with not only the prevention of war between member states, or between any states globally, because almost all nation states now are members of the UN, but it's also come to be concerned with the prevention or the remediation of human rights violations. So there are really two major topics of UN intervention on the world scene. You know, one has to do with the classical Kantian attempt to prevent the outbreak of war, and the second has to do with how does the world community act when, for example, genocide is occurring in a particular part of the world. The UN, of course, has an international Charter of Human Rights. And that charter actually has expanded over the years. And I should say this, just as kind of a background to what's happening here as well. There's a distinction and a debate over what the extent of human rights really is. What does a list of human rights comprise? There's pretty much universal agreement that such a list would include rights of personal liberty and political rights. So political rights are rights to participate in the political process. You know, the right to vote, the right to run for office, the right to speak out on public issues, and that sort of thing. The political rights. And then rights of personal liberty include things like the right to be secure in one's house and one's possessions from unreasonable search and seizure. You know, the right to worship the way you want to. The right to pursue your own version of a lifestyle, assuming that you don't interfere with the right of other people to make a similar pursuit. So we have political rights and rights of personal liberty. And in general, these two categories of rights are recognized by liberal constitutions, you know, including the U.S. Constitution, including the rights of man and the citizen, which was, you know, a part of the French Revolution, and so on. But there's a third category of rights that is controversial, and that in particular, at least one large portion of the political spectrum in the United States rejects, and that is the notion that there are social and economic rights. So The social and economic rights include things like the right to, within the limits of the capacity of the nation concerned, right? The right to medical care. The right to be supported for specific and limited periods of time during unemployment, when there's a crisis in the economy. The right to retire with some measure of dignity, and so forth. All of these are included under the rubric of social and economic rights, and they don't stem from the liberal constitutional tradition. They stem from, if you want to indicate their origin, from, let's say, the socialist and social democratic traditions. Social democracy is, when people talk about Sweden being socialist or something like that, what they really mean to say is that Sweden is a social democracy. A social democracy is a capitalist system that includes a fairly significant measure of redistribution of resources. So the idea is that the economy is capitalist, it's driven by the profit motive, and the vast majority of economic enterprises are privately owned. But then out of the profits that are made from that economic activity through taxation, redistribution occurs so that social programs are funded. And the purpose of funding those social programs is to put a floor under people so that the risks involved in participating in a competitive capitalist economy are ameliorated. So, clearly, if you have a competitive economy without any kind of floor at all, then it's possible for you simply to wind up in the street. Right? You lose your job. There might be some kind of a health problem in your family. You can't afford the bills anymore. You're out of work. And so you wind up in very, very dire straits. And so the social democratic approach to this is to create redistributive programs that prevent people from falling to the floor. Well, whether or not you believe that this approach is correct, of course, bears upon whether or not you think that there's such a thing as social and economic rights. Now, for example, this is a big issue in American politics right now. Now, the Obama administration has claimed that people have a right to medical care. And of course, a right to medical care is only real if people's access to medical care is assured. And that requires public spending. And public spending requires taxation. The Republicans have pretty much universally have rejected Obama's conception, begin by saying that there is no right to medical care. I wouldn't say that they all say this, but certainly the more ideologically coherent among them say this. There is no right to medical care. That medical care is an earned privilege. In other words, if you want medical care, you must work and make money in order to pay for it. And therefore what you get is a conflict over a conception of what the list of rights ought to contain. Should it contain just political and personal freedom rights, or should it also contain social and economic rights? The United States is a fairly unique case globally, because the United States is the only nation in which there has not been, at least in recent history, for the past 50 or 60 years, there has not been a viable socialist political tradition. The presence of socialist parties or labor-based political parties of some kind are ubiquitous across the world scene. There are very few countries that lack them. But the United States does. And the result of this is that the adherence of Americans to the idea of social and economic rights tends to be weakest on the world scene. Well, the U.S., of course, is in a position to enforce its will at the U.N. when it comes to questions having to do with international diplomacy, international conflict, the outbreak of war, and so forth. And that's because the U.S. is one of the five permanent members of the U.N. that has a veto on the Security Council. But the Security Council is not responsible for the human rights activities of the United Nations. The International Charter of Human Rights was drawn up by the General Assembly. And in the General Assembly, each nation has a single vote. In that context, the U.S., whether it's under a Democratic or a Republican administration is irrelevant, the U.S. is outvoted when it comes to recognizing the validity of social and economic rights. So the Bill of Rights, the International Charter of Human Rights, now includes the right to medical care, the right to a retirement with some measure of dignity, the right to support during periods of unemployment, and that sort of thing. It's interesting, though, that the United Nations has never considered, as far as I know, intervention in other nations in order to support the social and economic rights of citizens. Of course, when political and personal liberty rights are violated, that becomes a matter of international concern for the UN, and sometimes leading up to sanctions against a nation, sometimes even to invasion. But social and economic rights are much less, they're much more weakly rooted in the international system. They're there, though, and it's important to recognize that they're there on the international level. And presumably the United States is bound by this, because the Charter on Human Rights is a treaty, and it has the constitutional status of a treaty. And so treaties, by the reckoning of the U.S. Constitution, have the same force as domestic law. But of course, this never gets translated into anything real when it comes to the U.S. domestic policy. My point, though, is here we've got the UN Charter of Human Rights. Oh, by the way, one of the arguments in favor of social and economic rights is that if you don't have them, then political rights and rights of personal liberty become empty. So, for example, we all have the right to travel internationally. But that right is blank unless you can afford the plane fare. Right? You have the right to pursue all kinds of lifestyles, but the right is empty unless you can afford what's necessary in order to pursue them, and so forth. So one of the arguments in favor of social and economic rights is that without them, political rights and rights of personal liberty become much less real. Whether it's true or not, it's for you to decide. But collectively, these enter into the Charter of Human Rights, which is, of course, a UN document. Social and economic rights aside, when political rights, but in particular rights of personal liberty, are violated on a large scale, that is considered reasonable cause for UN intervention then. And there have been a number of cases where this has happened. I mean, the most glaring one, of course, was, well, actually there have been two that have been of fairly large scale. One was the intervention of UN forces. Well, the UN role in this was a little bit shadowy. Essentially, the UN gave its okay for the intervention of US and NATO forces in Kosovo and Herzegovina, the Balkans. And the idea was, at least the claim was, that the Serbian government was unleashing genocidal measures against its Muslim population, against the Muslim population of the Balkans, and this required international intervention to support the personal liberties, in this case the liberty to live, right, of the Muslim people of the Balkans. And so there was a major war in the Balkans, at least with the agreement of the United Nations. In the case of the first Gulf War, there were a couple of arguments there. One, of course, the more limited argument was that the international invasion of Iraq, and although the U.S. led it, this was a genuinely multilateral UN-sanctioned invasion, that the invasion of Iraq was justified by Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And so there had been a violation of the personal and political liberties of Kuwaitis by the Iraqi government. But then, of course, there was an added issue here, and that was the treatment of the Kurdish population. by the Iraqi regime. And there seems to have been a history, if not of genocide, certainly of massive slaughter involving so-called weapons of mass destruction, you know, including chemical weapons. Well, in any event, in those two cases, you had at least a UN umbrella under which nations coalesced and intervened in order to come to the assistance, at least ostensibly, of populations that were being victimized by governments. Now, Habermas is saying that this is now a recognized principle. It actually represents an expansion of the UN's mission. It's no longer simply a mission to avoid war. It's also a mission to protect the human rights of global citizens. But look at what that means. What that means is that people now are not only effectively citizens of their nation states, they are also citizens of the world. In other words, they possess rights that are enforceable even when they are being violated by their own governments. And this represents the emergence of a whole new political relationship globally. Now, you're not just a citizen of the United States, and you're not a citizen of the world in some kind of a starry-eyed, you know, vague sense for all God's children. You're a citizen of the world in the sense that you are covered by the UN Charter of Rights, and that and when that is violated, there is an agency, a power, a force to go to that can actually, in some cases, override the sovereignty of your government. Now, what Habermas does is he places his seal of approval on this. Essentially, what's happening is a cosmopolitan form of citizenship is emerging, which is an important addition to Kant's conception of a cosmopolitan world order in perpetual peace. Well, when you look at the institutional framework, you know, how does it differ from Kant's framework? First of all, Kant had an absolute restriction, which he indicates in the preliminary articles, against intervention in the domestic affairs of other countries. Now, clearly, that principle goes by the board if you recognize the legitimacy of UN intervention against human rights abuses. You could see this, what Saddam Hussein could say, my treatment of the Kurds is a concern for Iraqis, not a concern of the United Nations. And the UN has no right to intervene. No one has a right to intervene to violate the sovereignty of the Iraqi government. But what's now being recognized globally is that, you know, since the Kurds fall under the UN Charter, that there is a right to intervention on the part of a global force. So, first of all, Habermas says, essentially, you've got to get rid of that part of perpetual peace. Now the issue is, what kind of global structure is able to intervene in this way? And Habermas says that Kant was caught on the horns of a false dilemma. In other words, he dichotomized the possibilities. He broke them up into two categories, but there's actually a third possibility. And one of the possibilities was that there would be a world state, which Habermas seems to think that Kant wanted, although I don't see the ground for that, but that Kant felt was impractical and couldn't actually be pursued. The other possibility is the second best possibility for Kant, but it's the one that we're stuck with, is a free federation of nations. Now, remembering perpetual peace, since we've got a restriction against intervention, and since there is no global state, there's no provision for a military force that can be wielded by the Federation of Free States. In Kant's conception, what brings perpetual peace is simply the voluntary agreement of each member state to be bound by arbitration mechanisms, so that when they have disputes, instead of going to war, they go to an international court, in essence, and have those disputes resolved. But what happens when states bail out from that process? Or what happens when, as in the 20th century, and as we know, human rights violations occur? There's no provision in Kant's document for enforcing any of the decisions made by the global body. Now, would that require, as Kant believed that it would, a global government? In other words, a single centralized global state. And Habermas says, no, it would not. In fact, the UN has happened upon a third alternative. And what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is that there is no global army, right? In spite of the fact that the militias out west fear an invasion of UN, what they call UN bluecoats. You know, there's no UN army. Certainly there's no UN army of any significance. What happens is that when the UN decides, when the Security Council, in essence, decides that an intervention is warranted, member states supply the troops. So national armies remain the only source of military intervention. It's just that the intervention involves the coordination of national armies by the global body. So there's no standing army that the UN commands. There's the American army and the French army and, you know, the Sri Lankan army and so forth. And when there's the necessity for a global intervention, the Security Council has to pass a resolution without veto, which means that the five permanent members all have to agree to it. You know, Russia, China, is China one of the original? Yeah, China was one of the original. Russia, China, the United States, France, and England, right? They all have to agree to it. And at that point, an army is raised from the member nations under the umbrella of the UN, but usually involving commanders from the various nations. You know, the mission is engaged in and either completed successfully or it fails. And that's it. You know, the soldiers go back to their nations, their own nation states. This is neither a toothless federation of states, nor is it a centralized government, Habermas says. Now, it's really an essentially new form of global organization. Now, for Habermas, when it comes to... Were you going to say something, James? You look like you're formulating
it. I never heard that.
You never heard that? Yeah.
It's so crazy.
Yeah, the blue coats are coming. What's crazy about it, of course, is that in any international intervention, the vast majority of troops, of any significance, right? The vast majority of troops that are supplied by the United Nations, I mean the United States. So to have a blue coat invasion of the United States, you would have to have American soldiers invading the United States. Yeah?
I just have a question. You know, when citizens' rights are being violated, because of the Charter of Human Rights, that UN will get involved. Where does UN have to get approval to get involved in that matter?
Well, ultimately, the approval has got to come from the Security Council. In other words, in order for there to be economic sanctions, or in order for which is the milder version of intervention, right? In order for there to be economic sanctions or in order for there to be a military intervention, the Security Council has got to sign off. And that means unanimity among, if not unanimity, at least no opposition. You can abstain, right? And often, when the U.S. has tried to get UN approval, for example, of the second Iraq war, what it looked for was abstentions, but it didn't get them. It got opposition. Right? So if you get abstentions, and then approvals, you have a warrant to intervene. Now, the real question is, how does a citizen bring suit against his government, his or her government, right? And it's not the system is not exactly set up to permit that. And it's not that individual citizens get to bring suit. It's that, essentially, what happens is NGOs pressure the UN. In some cases. In other cases, you know, member states bring the issue up. NGOs are non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International, You know, Greenpeace is a non-governmental organization. CARE is a UN organization. The Red Cross is a non-governmental organization, and so forth. So when it comes to human rights, there are a whole series of NGOs now that are devoted to the human rights issue. And actually, Habermas is interested in recent proposals to reform the UN, and in particular, Kofi Annan, who is he still General Secretary? I forget. Is Kofi Annan still General Secretary?
It's the Korean fellow.
Pardon me?
It's the Korean fellow.
Yeah. Yeah, Annan is out right now. Yeah, that's what I thought. When Kofi Annan was General Secretary, he embraced a whole series of reform measures, and one of them was to bring the NGOs into a direct consultation relationship with UN human rights agencies, to actually incorporate them in some way into the official structure of the United Nations. I should say that there's another element to this whole story, in addition to the UN, but allied with it, there is something now called the International Criminal Court. I always get these two confused. Criminal Court. The UN has within it something called the World Court. The World Court is a judicial mechanism, mostly for dealing with things like disputes over the oceanic limit to national territory. Is it 5 miles? Is it 10 miles? Is it 15 miles? Stuff like that. But the International Criminal Court was established only about 6 or 7 years ago. And it was established outside of the UN process, properly so-called, although, as I say, pretty much in alliance with the UN. And the purpose of the International Criminal Court is to hear cases involving human rights violations. The International Criminal Court comes directly out of the Nuremberg trials. I don't think we've discussed Nuremberg in this class. It's really a very significant historical event which plays into the existing human rights policies of the United Nations. Nuremberg were the trials that tried the Nazi political and military leadership following the Second World War. Now, this is one of the few cases in which high-level military and political officials were prosecuted for human rights violations as opposed to grunts. You know, in Vietnam, for example, the My Lai case, which was an egregious violation of human rights. With My Lai, what happened was there was an American infantry unit that told that it was going to be engaging the enemy in a village in Vietnam, went in and found no enemy, found villagers and lined them up and shot them summarily and then sort of buried their bodies in ditches. And the only reason why this came to light was that there was an American helicopter pilot that intervened in the situation. And actually physically placed himself between the soldiers and the civilians who were being killed, but not until after about 150 of them had been slaughtered. And also actually ordered his helicopter unit to fire on the American infantry unit should they continue to kill civilians. And it's really an interesting case. This is an American helicopter pilot. And his intervention eventually let the story come out, and so there was a prosecution, but the only people who were prosecuted were the foot soldiers. You know, up to the rank of lieutenant. Lieutenant Cowley was one of the major accusers. Well, in Nuremberg, it wasn't the foot soldiers that were prosecuted, it was the highest officials of the German military and the Nazi political apparatus. Well, what happened was the Allies all contributed legal officials to the proceedings. They contributed judges, and they contributed prosecuting attorneys. And the person who was the head of the American involvement in the Nuremberg trials was a fellow by the name of Robert Jackson, who had been a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, Jackson was sent specifically to Nuremberg to lead the American legal team. And Jackson made an address to the Nuremberg court, which is fascinating. He tries to answer the Nazi charge that the only reason that they were on trial and not the Americans and the British and the Soviets is that they had lost the war. What they said was, if you had lost the war, we would be trying you right now. And what Jackson said to the court, his answer was really brilliant. What Jackson said to the court was, that's true. Obviously, that's true. You know, we would not be trying them. They'd be trying us had they won the war. But we would not have gotten the kind of trial that we are giving them. What they mean is, what he's referring to, is that they all had the right to an attorney of their choosing. They had the right to cross-examine witnesses. They had the right to present witnesses on their own behalf. In other words, they were accorded the full set of rights of a defendant under various Western judicial systems. Had we been on trial, it would have been a kangaroo court. You know, the verdict would have been predetermined. And in fact, by the time the trial was concluded, Jackson was proven correct, because not all of the defendants were convicted. A number of them were acquitted. Very few of them were given capital punishments. Some of them were hanged, but most of them were imprisoned. And of the ones that were imprisoned, many were let out early because of, you know, health reasons and other sorts of things. So it turns out that the Nuremberg trial was pretty much a fair trial. And that's what would not have happened had the tables been reversed. But still, the German argument preyed on Jackson's mind. Because, look at it a different way, take it to the next level. The Nazis were tried for human rights abuses. But Truman was never tried for dropping a bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The British Air Force officers were never tried for firebombing Dresden, this German city of Dresden, into oblivion. In other words, there were human rights violations on both sides. I mean, undoubtedly, the Nazi human rights violations were far more extensive and far more systematic than the Allied ones. But the point was that there were Allied violations that were never prosecuted under international law. And the Nuremberg Court never heard those cases. And so Jackson, for the rest of his life, pursued the project of creating or helping the creation of an independent international criminal court. And essentially, the criminal court, Jackson's been dead for a while, but the criminal court that came into existence about 6 or 7 years ago was the fruition of Jackson's dream. And the idea is that this is not attached to a particular nation state. It has an impartiality that enables it to make judgments that have some kind of standing in terms of principles of justice rather than simple principles of force. Now, when the International Criminal Court was created, Clinton was still president. And Clinton neither signed the treaty nor opposed it that created the International Criminal Court. When the Bush administration succeeded the Clinton administration, they refused to sign. And they refused to sign on the grounds that the criminal court would be used as a propaganda tool against the United States, and in particular against the U.S. intervention in Iraq. And Henry Kissinger, who had been Richard Nixon's Secretary of State, wrote a piece laying out the Bush administration's position on this. Kissinger was a bad person to pick for that, because Kissinger himself still cannot travel in certain European countries because he's under indictment for human rights violations involving, in particular, U.S. intervention, U.S. support of the Chilean government, which was a murderous government that killed all kinds of domestic citizens. But nonetheless, this was the position of the Bush administration. And so the U.S., and as far as I know, Obama has not signed on. I think Obama simply pursued the Clinton strategy of neither embracing it nor opposing it, but letting the treaty go unsigned. And so as a result, the United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court. So the only cases that have been tried or in the process of being tried by the International Criminal Court involve the Balkans, Milosevic, for example, the Serbian president, the past Serbian president, was being tried by the International Criminal Court for human rights violations, and also some deposed African leaders. Notice nobody that's currently in power, right? Well, clearly, in order for a system like the one that is emerging, and like the one that, that Habermas ultimately embraces, to have real force, so that it's possible to say that the way in which it works is the outcome of justice rather than of who is the biggest kid on the block, who has the biggest stick, right? In order for that to occur, there has to be an impartiality that the UN institutions currently lack. Yeah.
I think there is one present African leader up for indictment.
Is that right?
President of the Sudan?
That's possible.
The Sudan is, of course, an ungovernable chaotic entity, and the government is only nominal in the sense of the constitution.
Oh, I was just going to say that.
Yeah, it's fine. They had their first election a couple weeks ago in 20 years. I think it was all votes counted for. But I seem to remember his being brought up for indictment.
That's quite possible. But Kofi Annan, in particular, in his reform measures, addresses the issue that you've brought up in the past, James, which is that isn't it the case that the UN intervenes in cases of human rights violations only when the subject of intervention is not one of the big Western powers or a client government of one of the big Western powers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of what's sort of I think is meaningful about that is that Sudan is the only one that I can think of, and it's really been pretty awful there for a very long time. It's almost meaningless,
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I know the Annan reform includes the recognition that human rights interventions have been selective. In other words, that there's been a political criteria for selecting among all of the abuse cases in the world. Right? You invade against Saddam Hussein and not against, the Israeli government, for example, right? That kind of thing. And there's an attempt, at least, to address the issue, or the American government, for that matter. There's an attempt to at least address the issue of even-handedness and selectivity. But I doubt that it's going to get very far, at least in the immediate future. Yeah. Did you say something?
No.
Let me talk about one other element of Habermas' proposal here. Habermas thinks that there are a whole series of global issues now that are coming up that require a more extensive global organization, political organization, than Kant could have envisioned. I mean, for example, think about what happened during the economic meltdown that we were through a couple of years ago. It broke out in Wall Street. It broke out around the issue of defaults on mortgages. But then it toppled the big financial concerns in banks in London. It made an impact in China, although less of an impact on China. But all of Europe was caught up in it. Nations that were in Latin America and elsewhere that are used to selling to the United States, of course, were affected by it because their markets began to dry up and that sort of thing. In other words, we've got is now such an integrated, a globally integrated economy that what happens in any particular area is likely to spread across the planet. The Obama administration right now is talking about implementing regulatory measures to keep such a meltdown from occurring in the future. Whether you think that they're appropriate or not, or even going to be effective or not, is another concern. But even if the U.S. implemented regulatory mechanisms, that would not solve the problem, because the U.S. economy is now integrated into the global economy. Now, presumably, the only regulatory mechanisms that would really tame the financial sector would have to be global in character. And how do you bring that off? It's not the business of the UN to do that, according to Habermas. No, it's not. It's not a part of their charter. Their charter is to prevent war and now to prevent massive human rights violations. It's not to prevent the global economy from collapsing. Or take another example. Take the example of organized crime. You know, obviously, it's not simply the Colombians who have a stake in defeating the Colombian drug cartels. It's also the nations that the Colombian cartels sell to and do business in and actually have a presence in. And, think about the ecological crises that seem to be coming, you know, whether it's global warming or whatnot. Once again, they're not limited to particular nation states. They cross international boundaries. Now, the problem of immigration brings people across international boundaries. The need to establish an effective method of international communication and keeping the internet going and so forth crosses national boundaries. Yeah?
You said something about the drug cartel, and I was just wondering, wouldn't that be an invasion of like personal liberty to say that you can't use drugs? Like, as long as you're not stealing from other people and not affecting other people, isn't it your own liberty to be a drug user?
Yeah. There's a long history to this. To this debate. John Stuart Mill, who is one of the great classical liberal theorists, you know, the 19th century, wrote a book, very famous book, called On Liberty. And Mill is a utilitarian philosopher, one of the great utilitarian philosophers. Utilitarianism is a school of ethical philosophy, moral philosophy in England that argued that if you want to determine the correct policy to pursue, choose the one that creates the greatest happiness for the greatest number. It was a very simple criterion, and they had ways of making it operational. It appealed to a lot of people. But in any event, Mill wrote a book called On Liberty, in which he defends freedom in the following way. He says that the basic principle that should regulate political life is everyone ought to be free to do whatever it is that they wish, so long as it does not interfere with the similar freedom of others. So that the only legitimate rationale for government intervention against laws that regulate freedom is to maximize freedom for everybody, right? And he explicitly addresses the question of drugs. And the question is, in those days in England, you know, since England had operations in China and in India, the drug of choice was opium.
England fought a war to sell opium.
Pardon? Yeah.
You know, this is big business.
Yeah. The Opium War was a war in which England, by gunpoint, forced the Chinese to sell them opium. Well, what Mill argues is that drugs fall into the same category, you know, as any other exercise of personal liberty. But, he said, with two provisos. One is, and by the way, he's got the same regulations for the sex industry, for brothels during this period of time. He says you can zone. In other words, there's no reason why people in their communities should be troubled by having a brothel next door to their house, right? And you could also, in those days, there were opium dens, so you would zone for opium dens. Not every neighborhood. You wouldn't be able to smoke a pipe of opium in your neighborhood, but you go to an opium den in London and smoke a pipe of opium. But the other one is a more difficult one to apply, and that is, he said, you also have to recognize that the person who uses drugs may have personal responsibilities.
That's what I was going to say, self-destruction causing problems to family members, kids, and all that stuff.
Exactly. And he says, in those cases, it becomes reasonable to regulate and even prohibit drug usage. And presumably what you would do, I guess, is if you had a husband or someone who was not working and not contributing to the upkeep of the family, maybe you would get a court order, you know, to prevent them from, I don't know.
Okay, like a pilot using while flying a plane.
Right, exactly. So, but apart from that, you know, he argued that drugs should fall under the same rules that govern any other kind of personal behavior.
I still get, isn't this a recipe for war and peace?
That's a very good question. That's really an excellent question. Let me give you Habermas's answer to it, and you can tell me whether it's just a verbal solution. Habermas says that the military intervention on the part of a global federation like the UN against states that violate human rights abuses of their population is not war in any traditional sense. It's a police action. In other words, it's the use of force in order to enforce international law. And that's different than the case in which two nations come to blows over a conflict of national interests. So I think what Habermas would say, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think this is the spirit of what he says, is that when we move from this, if you have the social contract theory version of government, when we move from the state of nation of nature to a civil state, when we create a government and when we create laws that settle the war that exists between us domestically as individuals, that doesn't mean that we forego creating a police force. In other words, in order to maintain the peace, it's important to have a public agency that's empowered to use force in some cases.
Was he writing during nuclear time?
Habermas?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This piece was written about 5 years ago.
So what I don't get is if a small nation gets a hold of a nuclear weapon, they have the power to... I understand this in the sense of foot soldiers in the population, but nuclear power, a small nation who can take a nuclear bomb and take care of another nation, I don't see how
a federation could intervene.
At all.
Well, clearly, nuclear disarmament is going to be one of the major global issues that has to be resolved by a new international structure. Yeah, I think that's very clear. It's hard to imagine any of this really coming to pass as long as that's still in the field. Yeah, I agree. Okay, folks, start reading Foucault's chapter, okay? Start reading his chapter. You should read on torture, but it's not absolutely necessary. Read the Panopticon. The Panopticon, okay? The Panopticon by Michel Foucault. It's in the next section of the course. We're going to spend the last 2.5 weeks on surveillance. I've had enough of War and Peace. So go home and be good.
Sorry, it's just been ridiculous. All right, so how do you spell her last name?
Foucault?
Yeah.
F-O-C-A-U-L-T.
Oh, that's easy enough. What's the name of the piece?
It's called the Panopticon.
P-A-N?
P-A-N-O-P-T-I-K-O-N.
Fantastic.
Okay, or I-C-O-N. Maybe C-O-N, doesn't matter. You'll find it.
Okay, and so we're working on starting with our papers too, right?
Yeah, it's like 20 pages single space. It's really.
Which one do you?
And you have to defend it, like the way you defend a master's thesis or a doctorate.
Is it like a research? Like, do we need like a works cited page?
You know, I still haven't put those questions up. I promise I'll put them up tonight. Okay, so you'll be able to find them on our website this evening. Okay. Well. Everybody should be thanking me. Why this one person?
Thank you.
All right, there we go.
We were talking about this, the UN. I've only seen like, you know, North Korea.
Yeah.
But although they're not using, they're just using the creating the nuclear for their, it's not for their own goods. But in the meantime, I believe the citizen rights are being violated over there.